So the word in Pali, which is the language of the original Buddhist text, is dukkha, D-U-K-K-H-A, and it is conventionally translated as suffering. A lot of people don't like the word suffering in terms of the translation because they don't feel it completely captures all the nuances of that state. Also, it sounds so dire. I am very, very used to it because that's the translation I've always heard, and I never minded it. It means not just suffering in the blatant, overt sense. It also means insecurity, uncertainty, instability, dis-ease, incompleteness. There's a sort of very modern, obviously, translation of it as stress, which, coming from a fairly traditional background, is difficult for me to replace suffering with stress. But, of course, it can be taken in that way. And it is a range of aspects of reality that are contained in that word dukkha. You could say, and sometimes it's said that the Buddha talked about three kinds of suffering that we experience in life. And this is not to say that life is suffering or that we only experience unhappiness at all or that the purpose of life is to suffer, but much more a sense of how important it is to see the nature of things, that this is so much a part of life, and yet by ignoring it or overlooking it or trying to pretend it's not there, we don't achieve any greater happiness. In fact, we have a much larger amount of pain because we're just living in either confusion or hostility toward how things actually are. So three kinds of suffering that are talked about. The first is rather charmingly known, I think, as dukkha-dukkha. It's the suffering of suffering. This is the kind of pain or unhappiness or suffering that we commonly recognize as such. You have an injury. There's a loss. You're terrified. Although this last, you know, when it's a mental construct, when it's fear or anger or greed or something like that, we don't always recognize that as suffering. We often call it bad or wrong or terrible or wicked or consider ourselves bad for experiencing that state. So that's a translation we try to make right away, from viewing certain mind states and emotions as bad and wrong to seeing them as states of suffering. Okay, so dukkha-dukkha is something that when we look at it from the outside, we can pretty much say, yeah. You know, it might take some reorientation, it might take some retranslation, as in with certain mental states, but it's not that hard to call this suffering. You get sick. You lose your job, you lose your savings. You know, it's painful. And we know that if we really pay attention. If we're lost in a world of conceptual overlay, then we're not tuned in to how much suffering those things actually are. In order to have some kind of empathy for somebody else, in that state, of course, the first step is to have the experience of our own pain. And that opening, that awakening to the kinds of pain we can experience can be the basis for great empathy with others. It's also the basis for what's considered really the best kind of morality, which isn't subscribing to certain lists or do's and don'ts, but it's that kind of incredible sensitivity within where we know what it feels like or felt like to say, be lied to. You know, that sense of being belittled or almost annihilated and unseen and all of that. So the next time we're in a situation when it would be awfully easy to lie to somebody else, it's like we feel into what it was like to be on the other side of that, and we just don't want to go there. You know, so it's not condemning ourselves for the impulse or the temptation. It's not having a whole sort of self-righteous, holier-than-thou attitude, but we just don't want to go there. We know it hurts. And so opening to our own pain, being aware of it, is actually a tremendous asset to the development of empathy, compassion, morality, kindness, and so on. So it's dukkha, dukkha. And then the Buddha talked about a kind of suffering or a kind of dukkha that's not so overt, it's not so clear. It's more about the suffering of change. It's watching things fade away. It's getting what we want and having it pass. It's like the seasons of life. It's not so coarse, perhaps. It can be much more subtle than that. It's almost a kind of wistfulness that we can't hold on to anything. It's all just going. And so the Buddha used a lot of images to describe this aspect of life. He said, life is like a dream. It's like an echo, like a rainbow, like a drop of dew on a blade of grass, like a flash of lightning in a summer sky. It's there, it's gone, it's so tentative, it's dissolving even as it's appearing. And these images are very beautiful, so it's not like an ugly scenario, but there's just that sense of how ephemeral it is. And there's a little bit of heartache with that too, which is different than the acute pain of trying to hold on, which I'll talk about in a little later. It's more just that recognition. It's like watching a sunset. It's like, yeah, there it goes. I just had this really kind of funny experience where I got invited through some group of people in New York City who were doing a day of kind of like celebration of yoga and Indian spirituality. And I got invited to give a talk and lead a meditation, and I said yes. And the day was being held, as it turns out, in a building that was part of the Indian consulate in New York City. So I was sitting up on the stage, kind of like this, you know, and speaking. And then all of a sudden, I was flooded with this memory. And I asked someone there, I said, was this the place where the consulate was in 1970? And they said, yeah. And I said, you know, I came here 37 years ago to get my first visa to India. You know, as an 18-year-old college student, I came here. And I didn't know, you know, of course, how could I know what India would mean to me and that trip and learning the meditation. There was just that kind of inkling inside me that I needed to do it, or it was the right thing to do, or good things could come from it. But there was such total not knowing in a concrete sense, and just that tentativeness and that hope and yet not knowing, and the vulnerability and the courage, the willingness to go, and all of that. It was right there, you know? And I just kept looking around the room and thinking and saying, I was here 37 years ago. You know, it was an amazing feeling. And where did those 37 years go? You know, I don't think of myself as older than 37, actually, you know? But apparently I am. You know, it's just like so strange. You know, step by step, we move into a life, and it's like a dream, isn't it? 37 years, just like that, and yet. And we make these decisions, like, I think I'm going to try to go to India to learn how to meditate, or I'm going to study this, or I'm going to go here instead of there, work here instead of there, and who knows how it's going to link and move and evolve and change. And It's such a strange feeling. That has a little bit of a sense of dukkha too. It's not terrible suffering by any means, but there's just like this ache, you know, that life goes like that. So that sense of change is also very much in the sense of dukkha. And the changing nature of conditions, that we have pleasure and pain and gain and loss and praise and blame and fame and disrepute, as the Buddha said, that no one's life, whatever it looks like from the outside, is all pleasure and no pain. And no one has only praise and no blame. You know, you do something and some people love it and other people don't like it at all, and you think, do they, like, read the same book, you know? Like, but it's just like that, isn't it? Just the ups and the downs and the changes and the movement. So not only is it fading and kind of dissolving, but we go through all these different states all of the time. And it very much has a sense of like the seasons, you know, and there's nothing you can do about it. You can work really, really, really hard to do something right, and maybe you do it right, and someone blames you anyway. You know, it's just kind of like that in life. And then the third aspect of dukkha is yet more subtle and difficult to describe, which really has to do with the conditioned nature of existence, or the conditioned nature of reality, where everything arises due to causes and conditions coming together, that nothing arises independent of a flow of events. So, as one kind of example, you know, you might be thinking, what should I have for dinner tonight? But once you decide, dinner doesn't appear out of the, you know, machinations of one's mind. It's like you have to go shopping. Maybe to go shopping you need a car. In order to afford the car you need a job. In order to have the job you need to go to school for umpteen years. Or you need to go back to school. Or, you know, conditions need to come together for that, let's say, salmon to appear, you know, on your plate, not to mention the life of the salmon, you know. Everything arises due to conditions coming together. You know, and that is a kind of a crude example, but, you know, look at all the times when maybe we have somebody we really care about who's suffering a great deal, and we can't make a change. And we do everything we can to engage, to try to be helpful. And look at how much letting go there also needs to be. Because no matter how much we try, it's not in our hands. That everything comes together as conditions coming together and coming apart. And I once had a friend who was suffering terribly psychologically, and for a very long time, and I went to one of my teachers, this Tibetan teacher, to talk about it, really to kind of complain about it. And I was, you know, very unhappy because I couldn't make a difference, and it seemed. And I said to this teacher, I said, I don't think it's fair. You know, why don't we get one person where we could just look at them and say, poof, your suffering's gone. And it would be gone. Which is not to say that wouldn't be a problem also, like which person and, you know, when do you do it? You don't want to do it too soon, you don't want to do it too late. But even so, I was really complaining. And so I said, why don't we get one person? Just one. And the teacher said to me something like, that's why we call it samsara. That's why we call it this world of birth and death and of change, of not being in control. It's samsara. We do try, and we should try, to make a difference. And we don't know when. We don't know if. because conditions have to come together in a certain way. It doesn't mean we don't try. But there's also, it's like a poignancy, you know, that we're not in control, that things need to evolve, that healing has its own rhythm, or that other conditions need to come together. We can't make up people's minds for them. We can't make their choices for them. You know, it's very poignant in a way. So that's, it's like the suffering of conditions. Everything arises due to causes, not just through wanting or having something appear. And we need to put all those conditions in place to the best of our ability to have that result. So sometimes it's like an existential suffering. It's sometimes called the suffering of existence, or of conditions, conditioned reality. So the Buddha talked about that as well. So between the three, that covers a lot, you know, of how we actually experience life. But this is said to be in the nature of things. You know, this isn't aberrant, this isn't wrong. This is just in the natural unfolding of a life. And then we have the kind of suffering which tries to deny this, which is bitter about this, which distorts this, which tells us that if we only hold on tightly enough, this person won't change, this experience won't change. If we only assume a rigid enough control, that there will be no pain, there will be no blame, there will be no change. It's the kind of suffering that is huge, actually, in our experience of life. And it's the kind of suffering that doesn't take as natural those three, but feels there's something terribly wrong with them. And so, and certainly we see this as such a strong message in the society, where we feel like if we are suffering, it's bad, it's wrong, we should hide it, we should pretend it's not there. If someone else is, we should sort of nicely tuck them away somewhere, and not have to see it. And so the companion many, many times to dukkha in this society is isolation. It's really being cut off. It's feeling this separates me, or this should separate you. When you really think about it, I mean, if we had an understanding that this was in the nature of things, then dukkha or distress, or insecurity or vulnerability or unhappiness should be the thing that joins us together, because we share in this. It's not just you, and it's not just me, and it's not just now. This is kind of like a shared experience. So shouldn't it unify us? Shouldn't it bring us together to try to make for better conditions, to help one another if we can, to at least be there for one another if we can't somehow fix or change the situation, actually. And so we look at suffering as kind of the natural property in life, and we also look at everything that is added on to the truth of things that makes our experience so much worse. And one way of looking at that last is in terms of the primary forces, or the main forces in the mind, that form habitual and kind of maladaptive reactions to how things actually are. So the first of these, of course, is grasping or holding on or clinging. That doesn't mean enjoying things. It doesn't mean wanting in a sense of inspiration or aspiration or conviction or commitment. It really means holding on. And the Buddha said it in a very homey kind of way that makes a lot of sense to me. He said, if you hold on tightly to that which must inevitably change, it's like holding on tightly to a revolving wheel. He said, at some point or another in the cycle, you're bound to get run over. You know, and the wheel's just going and we are holding on tighter and tighter. And that's what happens. It's like we're living at a disjunctive angle to how change actually is. And so we cling. Sometimes it's in the form of this kind of forlorn fantasy almost. Like, if only I had whatever, then it would never change and I would be perfectly happy. And of course here too, the society is massively implicated in the kind of messages that we get. Like I live in Barre, Massachusetts, and I spend quite a bit of time these days in New York City. And I noticed that if you drive up what is the West Side Highway in New York City, which, you know, runs the length of Manhattan, there are many, many billboards, these really big billboards. And so driving up, I noticed that there was a new billboard out, fairly new billboard out, which is just this giant picture of a car and then one word, crave. Right? So that's the name of the new Honda, I guess it is, you know, the Crave. And it's so interesting because just driving up and you see one after another after another. And by the time you get to like the northern tip of Manhattan, it's like you really want that car. You know, it's like, yeah, I crave that. You know, and don't we hear that all of the time, and all of the time. It's so true. So that's one manifestation of grasping or clinging. It's that kind of wanting. We don't even know what we want. Or, you know, the Dalai Lama tells this great story about something like years ago he was, I think it was in L.A., and somebody took him to a mall like that sold a lot of electronics. And he said he walked through, and by the time he left, he wanted things. He didn't even know what they were. You know, he just saw that he wanted them. And we do, don't we? You know, so that's one side of it. And the other side of that kind of clinging or craving really is the holding on. It's the refusing to admit the truth of change in its totality. And so the more we try to refute that or distort it, the more kind of isolated we are from how things actually are, because we're fighting. You know, the opposite of that isn't not caring, and it's not indifference, and it's not a kind of apathy or a disengagement, but it's some real wisdom about how things unfold and the nature of change and what matters to us and things like that. And actually a better ability to enjoy things because we're not always looking for the next or postponing or trying to hold on in some way, but can actually more fully experience what is. Said the second kind of major habit of mind that vastly increases our suffering is the opposite energetically of clinging or craving, and that's aversion, which is anger and fear. And this doesn't mean that it's wrong to feel these things, but when we, in a way, consolidate around them, when they become habitual, when it is our means of trying to be happy, then, of course, we're in tremendous trouble. And as many of you know, the Buddhist psychology talks about the state called aversion, which is anger and fear, which are considered exactly the same mind state, anger being the outflowing, expressive, energized form, fear being the kind of held in, frozen, imploded form, but they're the same mind state of striking out against what's happening, trying to declare it to be untrue, really trying to push it away, being somehow feeling that if we can assume some kind of control, this would not have happened, or it will cease to be. And that may not be true at all, as conditions come together in certain ways. So again, it's not that these states are bad or wrong or illogical in many situations. It seems the most natural kind of response. But it's interesting to and important to really look deeply at them. You know, in the Buddhist psychology, anger is likened to a forest fire which burns up its own support. So it can leave us devastated. You know, even though it has an energy and that's very positive and it has a strength and that's very positive, and it often has a kind of courage too. Sometimes it's the angry person in the room who's the only one willing to say something that no one else wants to, you know, look at or admit. So those are all the positive things, but it can be devastating. It can destroy us. You know, you can't hold it. You can't sustain it as a nourishing factor seeking change because it's so destructive. And like a forest fire, it can burn wild so that we might end up in a place very far from where we want to be. So what happens when it becomes habitual? When it's our ready response to whatever is going on, when we begin to take everything personally that is happening, when we're so undone, we're so devastated by the force of that anger that we actually can't do anything to try to make a change for ourselves or for someone else. Those are not far away considerations, you know, for many of us. That's something that we really experience in a direct way quite immediately. So it becomes an important challenge and a great question. Like, can we not lose that kind of strength or energy, but not be so lost in the kind of devastating burning of just striking out against what's happening or not having that become this kind of habitual pattern? And I think one of the ways it's interesting to explore these states is to understand what it means in terms of ourselves. And so I try to use that as a means of examining and coming to a greater understanding of these states. So what does it mean to be kind of perpetually, habitually angry at oneself? That's revealing. You know, what if you are in the habit, say, at the end of the day, of looking back at yourself during the day and kind of evaluating? And what if, as part of that habit, you also tend to obsess about or fixate on the negative, the mistake you made, the thing you regret saying, the way you did whatever, you know? And if you just feel your way into that collapse, that certainty that all you are and all that you will ever be is that person who said that really stupid thing at that lunchtime meeting, you know, everything that's involved in that collapse, the limitation, the burning, the closing down, that's the nature of that state. So what would it mean to open up to a perspective beyond that? It doesn't mean that you try to disguise what happened so that you're not saying, in effect, wasn't that a brilliant and witty thing I said at lunch, you know? Maybe it was really stupid. But that's not all that we are. And in fact, when we talk about loving kindness tomorrow, I'll talk about this a lot more. What would it mean to look back at the end of the day, to have your mind automatically and habitually go to the mistake you made, and also ask yourself, anything else happened today? You know, to open to a different perspective. So those are the kinds of ways that we come to understand. You know, look at how much in life is not meant personally, but we take personally. You know, having just traveled here, I mean, my plane was, what, an hour late or something? Which is nothing, really, these days. You know, but sometimes you can just feel, like, the agitation in people, you know, like, how dare they? And you think, yeah, I'm not happy either, but, you know, it's not really exactly like that, like a personal slight, you know. Or the ways in which we can blame ourselves for a choice where there was no way of knowing, in fact. It's not something personal. Like, I think I'm the only person in the universe who says in a really doleful way, I had to go to Maui this year. And I said I'd go back next year, which is really depressing. Because as wonderful as it might seem, I went to teach a retreat with Ram Dass and my friend Krishna Dass, who many of you know. Krishna Dass does Hindu devotional chanting, and Ram Dass was a very important figure in my early years of practice and for many people. And Ram Dass has been living in Maui, not traveling, for a couple of years. And I agreed to go, and I was in New York. And Krishna Dass said to me, well, the only way to really get there is to, sensible way to get there, is to stop in San Francisco, because we were going to San Francisco afterwards to see the Dalai Lama. So he said, stop in San Francisco, spend the night at an airport hotel, get a night's sleep, get on another plane the next day, get to Maui. So I talked to my travel agent about that, and he said, well, you know, I don't think so. He said, I have a great flight for you. It's just a 2-hour layover in San Francisco. You know, you'll get to San Francisco, you'll have 2 hours, you get on another plane, you'll get to Maui, it'll be much easier. So I said okay to my travel agent, and that's what I did. So then I flew to San Francisco, and of course it wasn't a 2-hour layover, it was a 6.5-hour layover because the plane was late coming from Chicago. So I was in the San Francisco airport for 6.5 hours. And the beginning of that was this vortex of self-blame. I can't believe how stupid I am. Why did I make this choice? This was so stupid. Why didn't I listen to Krishna Dass? I could have been lying down in a bed by now. You know, this is really awful. But why did I do this? And what should I do? Should I, you know. Finally, I decided just to stay in the airport. I let go of it. I actually had a fine old time for about 6 hours. And then got another plane, got to Maui. By the time I got to Ram Dass's house, I'd been traveling for 21 hours. I realized I could have gotten to India, you know, and there I was. So the next day I saw Krishna Dass, and I said, I was so stupid. I should have listened to you. And he said, no, I was so stupid. He said, I got to the airport hotel. I couldn't go to sleep till 3:30 in the morning. I had to get up at 4:30 in the morning to get on the next flight. I only had an hour's sleep. I was totally exhausted. So my first conclusion from all of that is that there's no easy way to get to Maui from the East Coast. So next year when I'm going, this is true, I'm spending a week in L.A. on the way there. And also, it's so interesting, you know, like, I am so stupid. This was really, I mean, really, how are we constructing the universe that we imagine we should have this kind of perfection, you know, that if we were in tune, nothing would go wrong, that somehow we are the center of everything. It's quite interesting, isn't it? And what incredible suffering, because how many times are we disappointed in a day? And somehow we're taking that all to really be centralized within us rather than seeing this web of conditions coming together. Certainly we make mistakes. and we need to learn from them. And I have, believe me. But that sort of pressure, you know, and that intense kind of suffering, that's a machination of the mind. That doesn't reflect how things actually are. Okay, and then the last of the kind of major habitual forces, of course, is grasping, there's aversion, and then there's delusion. You could say that grasping tends to come up when our experience is pleasant and we want to keep and hold and have more of it. Aversion certainly when our experience is unpleasant and we want to push it away or make it go away. And then delusion, one of the ways in which delusion comes up is when our experience is largely neutral. And we notice that we actually have a kind of seeking of intensity where we want things to be very intense, either pleasant or unpleasant, just in order not to be bored or have that kind of numbness or not to fall asleep in a way. We need something to jolt us awake. And that becomes its own kind of force. We're not, by and large, highly trained to subtlety. But what would it be like if we actually had a very full sense of connection, feeling a bottle of water like that, or breathing, or feeling a step, or hearing a sound, or feeling the breeze? Kind of ordinary experience that we might just discount or disregard or move away from or disconnect from, go to sleep in the face of. It would be a different kind of day, wouldn't it? Not to have that kind of restlessness, I've got to have something else happen. And be kind of more interesting and enjoyable. So we have suffering, as the Buddha described it. We have these kinds of dukkha. And we also have the kind of more habitual ways of relating to life as it actually is that solidify our sense of separation, that magnify our suffering, sometimes enormously. And it's in working through these three, being able to not be so bound to them, that we come to a very different way of being. It's not that all pain goes away and there's only pleasure. It's not that change ceases to happen. But we are totally different with it. And so we live in harmony with how things actually are. And there's a quality, many qualities of joy that are not conventional happiness, that aren't so fragile and so subject to change. And that's really why and how we practice.